If you would, take your Bibles and turn to 2 Chronicles, because that's the book that we were going to go through tonight. I'm trying slowly, every once in a while, to get another book of the Bible summarized for you. And the book of 2 Chronicles really is something we're going to basically cover the same time period that we've already covered. The book of 2 Chronicles covers the same time period as 1 and 2 Kings. So the two books of 1 and 2 Kings is both covered by 2 Chronicles. Where the books of 1 and 2 Kings were basically a compilation of the prophets who lived at the times the events happened, most likely being compiled by Jeremiah, 2 Chronicles, though, gives us a different viewpoint. It talks about, from a historical viewpoint or a historian's view, looking back at the events. Most people believe that 1 and 2 Chronicles was probably written by Ezra, because the book of Ezra actually continues the same story, and we'll talk about that later. 1 and 2 Kings show basically a progressive rise and then decline of both the northern and southern kingdoms of Israel. But the emphasis in 2 Chronicles focuses almost entirely on Judah, on the southern kingdom. And the reason for it is, and what we find as we go through 2 Chronicles, most of the emphasis is placed on the good kings. If you go back through 1 and 2 Kings, you'll find that the more text volume is given in 1 and 2 Kings on the evil kings. But when you look at Chronicles, 1 and 2 Chronicles, especially 2 Chronicles, what you find is a lot of details given about the good, the godly kings. Very little is mentioned, even though they are covered, the evil kings that occurred in Judah. So you find a lot of emphasis on Solomon, on Asa, Jehoshaphat, Joaz, Hezekiah, and Josiah. In fact, more emphasis is given on these kings who preserved righteous worship, which then eventually allowed a remnant to return to restore Israel. So 2 Chronicles goes from all the way from Solomon's reign up to the captivity, and actually has a little bit at the very end of the book that talks about the return from the captivity. So it goes all the way to that point from the return from the Babylonian captivity. Now if you turn to the book, I'm going to hopefully make it a little shorter summary, and maybe it'll be a little bit easier to follow because we're not going to jump around like we did in 1 and 2 Kings, where you're going from the southern kingdom to the northern kingdom, back to the southern kingdom, and getting very confused about who's coming when where. This is solely focusing on the kingdoms of Judah. It begins with Solomon's reign at the beginning of 2 Chronicles. Solomon reigned for 40 years. The first 9 chapters of 2 Chronicles deals with Solomon's reign. It starts out in chapter 1 with Solomon's inauguration. And this also recounts the time when he asked God for wisdom. Chapters 2 through 5, so we got to devote 4 chapters just on the rebuilding, or the building of the original temple. And again, we see that's what is more important to the writer of Chronicles is the worship of God. And so 4 chapters are actually devoted to the details about Solomon building the temple. Another reason probably also is there's a lot of emphasis on there is because if it was Ezra who was writing it, they're about to rebuild the temple. And here was some details about what the first temple looked like. Chapters 6 and 7, so we have 2 whole chapters dealing with the dedication of that temple. Now notice we haven't spent all that much time on Solomon's life. We talked about the events about it, but now we spend basically 6 chapters out of the 9 that are on Solomon's life dealing with the temple. And that, 6 and 7 deal with the dedication ceremony that was started the temple. And then chapters 8 and 9 give us a list of Solomon's accomplishments, the things that he did, the things that made him noteworthy. And especially, like, for instance, in chapter 9, we have the visit from the Queen of Sheba. There's discussions about Solomon's wealth and the glory and grandeur of his reign. And that covers the first 9 chapters. The remainder of Chronicles, up through chapter 35, 36 is basically a very short summary, but I guess we could also throw 36 in there as well. The remainder of Chronicles talks about all the rest of the kings of Judah. And we just go down historically, one right after the other. Every once in a while, some of the kings of Israel are mentioned as they interact with Judah, but basically the focus is on the kings of Judah. Rehoboam was Solomon's son. And as a son, he was not nearly as wise as his father. And his reign was covered in chapters 10 through 12. In chapter 10 is a recounting of how Rehoboam split the kingdom. When he started up on his throne, he wanted to solidify his reign. He asked for advice. His father's advisors told him that he needed to relieve the taxes because there was a man on the sidelines, Jeroboam, who was trying to cause trouble. And if he could relieve the taxes, he would win the people back over. The young people at his time said, no, the way to get people to buckle down underneath your rule is to make it even harder for them. And Jeroboam won the people away. And Rehoboam basically was left with just 2 tribes, essentially Judah and the tribe of Benjamin, depending how you want to look at it. In 2 Chronicles 11, one of the important facts that we learn in this chapter is, starting about verse 13, it says, and the priests and the Levites, who were all in Israel, presented themselves to him from all the places where they lived. For the Levites left their common lands and their holdings and came to Judah and Jerusalem because of Jeroboam, and his sons cast them out from the serving as priests of the Lord. Jeroboam established his own religion. And you might have, when you read 1 and 2 Kings, you wonder, well, what happened to all the priests and the Levites? Because they were scattered throughout the whole land. 2 Chronicles tells you what happened was they all picked up and moved south because Jeroboam had thrown them out in order to solidify his idolatrous worship. Also in chapter 12, we find another major mistake that Rehoboam did. We find out that Shishak, the Pharaoh of Egypt, plundered Judah. When Rehoboam and the people basically stopped following the laws of God, they did pretty well while they kept following God's laws. But when they stopped following, God let Shishak, who was Pharaoh of Egypt at that time, come north. And he just absolutely plundered Judah of their wealth. Chapter 13 then goes to the Rehoboam's son, Abijah. And for the most part, it recounts the war between Judah and Israel. And here's one that, even though Abijah is not known to be a good king, he's an evil king, he did manage to push Israel back. Israel was basically trying to extend their territory down into Judah's area. And Abijah did manage to push Jeroboam back, kept him within his borders. And that's about all you can say about Abijah. Asa is covered in chapters 14 through 16. So we have 3 chapters on the king of Asa. One of the things he's noted for in chapters 14 is that he got to begin his reign with 10 years of peace. There are not too many times in Judah's history since the reign of Solomon that they actually had periods of time when they weren't at war with somebody. And Asa had 10 years of peace and was able to spend that time rebuilding Judah, getting things back into place, getting the fortifications back in line, building the army back up, and a good thing because there was an invading army from Ethiopia, all the way from down in Egypt, below Egypt, down in Africa, had came up to plunder, and they were able to successfully fight them off. In chapter 15, we find out that Asa, basically during Rehoboam's reign and at Abijah's reign, there was idolatry took a hold. That's why Abijah is known as such an evil king, because he led idolatry into Judah. Asa spent a good portion of his reign trying to wipe that out again, removing as much as he could. And we find his dedication here because he didn't spare anyone. If you look in chapter 15, 2 Chronicles 15, in verse 16, it says, even Maacah, his mother, King Asa removed from being queen mother because she had made a detestable image for Asherah. Asa cut down her image, crushed it, burned it at the brook of Kidron. And so he even took a stand against his own mother. And when she wanted to go into idolatry, he kicked her out. Which tells you why he was recounted as one of the good kings of Israel. It's not that he was without flaw. Chapter 16 tells about a tragic mistake that he made towards the end of his reign. He bribed Syria because Israel kept trying to fight again. He kept trying to push the borders down. And Asa was tired of it. Baasha was the current king of Israel. And so he came up with the idea that he needed, if somebody would just distract Baasha from invading his territory, then he could at least have some peace. So he sent bribe money up to Syria and asked them if they would attack Baasha on the north side. That way Baasha would not be worried about his southern border anymore. It worked, but Hananiah the seer soundly scolds him. And in chapter 16, verse 7, it says, at that time Hananiah the seer came to Asa, the king of Judah, and said to him, because you relied on the king of Syria and did not rely on the Lord your God, the army of the king of Syria has escaped you. Were not the Ethiopians and the Libyans a huge army with many chariots and horsemen? Yet because you relied on the Lord, he gave you into your hand. For the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to give strong support to those whose heart is blameless toward him. You have done foolishly in this, for now on you will have wars. Unfortunately, Asa, again, didn't do too well because he didn't like the answer. Instead of acknowledging the fact that he justly was scolded, notice what he does in verse 10. And Asa was angry with the seer, put him in stocks in prison, for he was in a rage with him because of this. And Asa inflicted cruelties upon some of the people at the same time. So he starts out really well. But towards the end, he just loses it. And he spends the rest of his kingdom, the time that he had, fighting wars on all sides. The next king that we have is starting in chapter 17. He actually gets chapter 17 all the way to 20. So he has four whole chapters devoted to him. And that's the king Jehoshaphat. He also, like Asa had built up Jerusalem, but he basically lost it fighting all the wars that Judah had to fight. Jehoshaphat, at his reign, begins again rebuilding Judah, putting things back, getting things back in shape. But then we find, and that was basically what chapter 17 is about, but chapter 18, what we find is that he makes the big mistake. Almost every one of these kings makes some major mistake. And in this case, Jehoshaphat's big mistake is he decided to make an alliance with Israel. He decided to marry his son to Ahab's daughter. And you think of all the kings that he had to pick. Ahab's daughter was probably the worst possible pick that he could make. And one of the prophets at that time, Micaiah, prophesies that both the defeat of Ahab and the death of Ahab. That's when he got it asked who's going to be able to persuade Ahab to go to battle. And Micaiah was able to record that. and was part of that convincing. And Jehoshaphat was up there, but he manages to escape with his life, at least, from that battle. Chapters 19, he then returns to Judah, and he begins a long series of reforms, putting the people back to following God. That's why he's known as a good king. In chapter 20 is one of the more interesting accounts, being attacked by a union of Moabites and Ammonites. Jehoshaphat decides that what we need to do is rely on God. And most of 20 is the prayer that Jehoshaphat offers up to God in front of the people, telling them that they're going to rely on God. He then has the people go out to march. His army goes out to march. And yeah, they have their swords and stuff like that, but basically what they go out to do is they go out marching, singing praises to God. They're probably like no other battle you've ever seen. They just go out and they sing. And that was Jehoshaphat's idea. And God was impressed. And basically by the time Jehoshaphat and his army got to where the Moabites and the Ammonites were at, they were all dead. And the reason for it was that they got into a conflict with the Edomites at the time. They started fighting each other. And by the time Jehoshaphat and his army got there, they had already killed each other off. So God gave him a victory. And what's the amazing thing is because they put their trust completely in God. Jehoram was the next king in chapter 21. He was not a great king. He starts out his reign, his whole 8 years of reigning, by killing off all his brothers and basically most of the leaders of Judah because he didn't want any competition for the throne. He's the one who was married to Ahab's daughter, Adaliah. And he follows his wife's religion. So after, you know, Asa had tried restoring things, Jehoshaphat did a lot of restoration, Jehoram basically reversed the whole thing and brought idolatry in back into Judah. God was quite angry with him. And if you read towards the end of chapter 21 in verse 18, it says, "And after this, the Lord struck him in his bowels with an incurable disease. In the course of time, that at the end of 2 years, his bowels came out because of the disease, and he died in great agony. His people made no fire in his honor, like the fires made for his fathers. He was 32 years old when he began to reign. He reigned for 8 years in Jerusalem. And when he departed with no one's regret, and they buried him in the city of David, but not in the tombs of his kings." Talking about this morning, about what, how will people remember you? Here was a king that led Israel into idolatry. They knew it was wrong. And no one missed this king when he died. They didn't bother giving him an honorable burial. He was followed by Ahaziah. Again, Ahaziah starts out, and this is chapter 22. Most of the chapters in Chronicles actually are divided between the king's reigns. Ahaziah only managed to reign 1 year, but he starts out by killing off all of Jehoram's sons. He didn't kill them off, sorry. A group of Arabian marauders came by, killed off all of Jehoram's sons, and so Ahaziah is the only one left, and so he's made king. He's the youngest son of Jehoram. Since he probably was young, he was very heavily influenced by his mother, who was still alive, Adaliah. So he practiced the idolatry. His mother, it mentions, was his counselor. Verse 3 of chapter 22, he also walked in the ways of the house of Ahab, for his mother was his counselor in doing wickedly. So he also practiced, and then while he was visiting his uncle up in Israel, that happens to be the time when Jehu has his great coup that wipes out Ahab's lineage, and as Ahaziah is wiped out as well. The last part of chapter 22 then covers the fact that Adaliah, his mother, then killed all the remaining heirs to the throne. Fortunately, she missed one through God's help, and took over the kingdom and reigned for it for 6 years. Chapters 23 and 24 are then that one son that she missed, the youngest one, was saved by his uncle, Jehoiada, who was high priest at that time. And Joash was the king, and Jehoiada stages a coup, kills Adaliah, sets up Joash, even though he's just a young boy, and sets him up as king in Israel, or in Judah. Chapter 23 basically lists out all the things that Jehoiada actually is the one who initiated, because he's the brains behind the throne. But under Joash's reign, the temple is rebuilt. There's a lot of reforms that are put in place. Idolatry is starting to be brought back down under control. Adaliah was executed at the beginning of his reign. And so he did a lot of good things at the beginning of his reign, but then his uncle dies. And we find out then Joash really wasn't doing these things. It was Jehoiada who did it. Because when he dies, in verse chapter 24, the rebuilding of the temple is at the beginning of it. But then by the time we get to the end of the chapter, he's falling into sin, following after his own ways, following after what other people advise, even kills off Jehoiada's, his cousin, Jehoiada's son, who was a prophet, because he didn't like what was being said. And at the end of his reign, he ends up being assassinated because the people did not like him. The next king that comes after chapter 25 is Amaziah. This king was a so-so king. We talked about that in a sermon not too long ago. He tried to serve God, but he only did it partly. He didn't do it with his whole heart. He did it because it was convenient and because God gave him some benefits. But while he was off defeating the Edomites, which was his main concern, his grandfather, Jehoram, a great-grandfather, had lost Edom as a subject territory. While he was off regaining that territory, Israel had attacked from the north side. And it's pretty clear from the account that Amaziah had blamed God for that, and then turned against God and did not live out his reign very well towards the end. Chapter 26 is Uzziah. He again starts out as a good king. He beginning of the chapter talks about all the successful battles he has. He wins a number of battles, pushing back a lot of the various kingdoms around, putting Judah's territory back. But somewhere during his reign, he decided that, no, he's doing so much, God's so obviously with him, that he should be allowed to give God worship. And so he decides to go into the temple himself to offer worship to God, and he was struck with leprosy. And so even though technically he reigned 52 years, he was one of the longest reigning kings, he couldn't actually reign on the throne. He was in the back closet, basically, and his sons had to take over the reign because he was a leper for the rest of his life, because he was too prideful to listen to what other people had said. Jotham then took over the reign. He actually continues the reformations that Uzziah had begun. He's also known for conquering the Ammonites. That takes care of chapter 27. Down towards the end of, that was 27. In chapter 28, it's very short, 27 is a short chapter. In chapter 28 is Ahaz. He's a wicked king. He reintroduces, you see these cycles. You got a number of good kings that are trying to put everything back, get rid of the idolatry, and then another king comes along, introduces idolatry, and goes even worse than before. So they haven't got the last cleaned up before they're going back into idolatry again. Ahaz reintroduced idolatry. He did manage to defeat Syria. He went to battle to Syria, and Syria defeated him because of his wickedness. Rather than learning from his mistakes, it says in chapter 28 and verse 22, in the time of his great distress, he became more faithless to the Lord, the same king Ahaz, for he sacrificed to the gods of Damascus, which had defeated him, saying, because the gods of the kings of Syria helped them, I will sacrifice to them that they may help me. Which sounds very backwards, doesn't it? Because that army beat me, therefore I'm going to start worshiping their gods, because obviously their gods are stronger than my God, basically his philosophy. And so, instead of learning from mistakes, he became more set in them and was one of Israel's worst kings. Fortunately, though, his son, Hezekiah, comes next. Hezekiah actually has chapters 29 to 32. Again, he has a large number of chapters devoted to him. And what he's known for is he begins in chapter 29, and what we have is an accounting of all the reformations that Hezekiah did, and how he cleansed the temple. Chapter 30 is all about how he reestablished the Passover. Notice how the emphasis is not on what the kings did so much as the battles they won, the politics that were going on. The emphasis is on the worship. In chapter 31, Hezekiah reorganizes the priests so that they can serve. There are things that fall into a mess under his father's reigns. And also in chapter 32 is probably one of the more famous chapters, where he is attacked by the Assyrians. He pleads to God for help. And he is then rescued by them, by God killing off the Assyrians in an overnight campaign by one angel. But at the end of 32, we find that Hezekiah makes a big mistake. Again, good kings, they do a lot, but towards the end of their lives, a lot of them kind of fell off. His big mistake was he had envoys from Babylon come by, and he showed off all his wealth. And God, through Isaiah, scolds Hezekiah and says, because you did this, you've set in order events that are basically going to end up with your kingdom being taken off into captivity. For all of Hezekiah's greatness, and you think especially the fact that his father was so bad, his son followed after his grandfather. His son was probably one of the most evil kings that Judah ever faced. In fact, I find his story so fascinating that I'm probably going to, as soon as I can get one written, I'm going to talk in detail about Manasseh's reign. Manasseh restored evil, restored idolatry. He said did more evil than all the nations that God had conquered and had driven out of Israel. He reestablished, allowed the idolatry practice, the worships of Molech, the burning sacrifice of kids. We're all done by his reign. One passage, I forgot to jot down the verse, basically talked about how the streets in Jerusalem ran with blood in his reign. But something happened to Manasseh that's interesting. Notice that all the kings that we've talked about, how many kings went off and did a lot of good, and then in the end of the reign they did bad. Manasseh, because of all that he did, was captured by the Assyrians, dragged off to Babylon. And while he was there, he repented of his sins, which is fascinating. Probably the most cruel, evil king that you can possibly imagine. And he repented, and God allowed him to return. And what we find here in this book is that he spends most of the rest of his life trying to undo all the evil that he did. He pulls out all the idolatry. He puts people back into following worship. He was basically a zealot for God for the rest of his life. Unfortunately, at the end of chapter 33, he's followed by his son Ammon. Ammon manages to undo everything that Manasseh did and brings the idolatry right back. He is, though, fortunately, followed by Josiah. Josiah is a good king. He again restores the true worship. He removes all the idols. And one of the things that had happened during Manasseh's reign is they had lost the books of God. They misplaced them. They got lost in the temple. And they were actually found while the temple was being restored. He has them read to him, and he realizes how far they had departed from the worship of God. And he repents on behalf of the people. And God sends a prophet to him and said, because you repented and because you reacted in this way, with tears when you found that you weren't following my laws, he said, the plans that I had to wipe Judah out, I'm putting them off. You're not going to see it during your reign. They're still going to happen. The events are still going to come about, but I'm going to delay it so it's past your reign. In chapter 35, he again restores the Passover, just like Hezekiah did. But he also makes a tragic mistake towards the end of his reign. His mistake was he decided to do battle against Egypt. And the king of Egypt even warns him, don't do this. And what's fascinating is the book of Chronicles tells us that the king of Egypt was speaking as a prophet of God in this case. Speaking on behalf of God to say, don't do this. But he did it anyway. And he gets killed in that battle. The very last chapter of Chronicles, I didn't make it in a decent time. The very last chapter of Chronicles, chapter 36, then covers the last several kings in quick succession. Because each one was evil and they didn't do much as far as doing anything godly during their reigns. The last several kings are mentioned, Jehoaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, and Zedekiah. Then Israel is captured by Babylon for 70 years. And at the very end of the book, it says that they are then released and by Cyrus to return and restore the temple. In verse 17 of chapter 36, it gives you a good summary of what happened. It says, therefore he brought up against them the kings of the Chaldeans, who killed their young men with the sword in the house of the sanctuary, and had no compassion on the young men or the virgin, old men or aged. He gave all of them into his hands, and all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, the treasures of the house of the Lord, the treasures of the king and his princes, and all these he brought into Babylon. They burnt the house of God, they broke down the wall of Jerusalem, burnt all his palaces with fire, and destroyed all his precious vessels. He took them into exile in Babylon, those who escaped from the sword, and they became servants to him and to the sons until the establishment of the kingdom of Persia, to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, until the land had enjoyed its Sabbaths. All the days that it lay destitute, it kept Sabbath to fulfill 70 years. And now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, that the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah might be fulfilled, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he made a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and also put it in writing, "Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heavens, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has charged me to build him a house at Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever is among you of all his people, may the Lord his God be with him, let him go up." And so it ends on a high note. To say that at least God allowed the worship to return. Why? It wasn't because Judah was such a good people. They deserved their punishment. They deserved the destruction that happened. But at the same time, though, there were numerous good kings who tried to restore things and put things back in the right order. And if it wasn't for that memory that kept being reestablished, even though they lost ground, that's what led to the eventual restoration of Judah and the kingdom of Israel. Sometimes when we're fighting battles, sometimes when we're working against what seems to be overwhelming odds against us, somebody has to keep the light shining. And those people have an effect on the world. It might look like you're losing ground, but eventually God can use it to his benefit and his glory. And so we see that while they lost a lot of things, they kept plugging at it. And they never lost totally, like Israel did. They never lost totally the worship of God. I hope you'll think about these things this evening. We'd like to offer an opportunity as we gather together again. If there's anyone here who's not a child of God, there's no better time than right now to put on Christ. If there's anyone here who is a child of God, we'd like prayers of brethren on our behalf. Why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song, Selected.